Hello and welcome to this special SearchSecurity.com Newsmaker podcast, where we feature in-depth interviews with thought leaders in the information security market. Thank you for joining us today. I'm Bill Brenner. Our guest today is a man who has always lived on the forefront of security, even when being there had dire consequences. A 20-plus year veteran of the information security realm, he earned his Bachelor of Science from MIT and his PhD in biostatistics from Harvard in 1988. He's known for a prestigious body of work at organizations such as the Harvard School of Public Health, MIT's Project Athena, Digital Equipment Corp, Certico, and At Stake. He's a former president of the USENIX Association, and he's perhaps best known for a controversial 2003 report he co-authored for the Computer and Communications Industry Association entitled Cyber Insecurity, The Cost of Monopoly, in which he accused software giant Microsoft of being a security monoculture. Without further ado, we're pleased to be joined by Dan Gier, Vice President and Chief Scientist for security consulting firm Vertisys. Dan, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
For our listeners, we'll spend the first 10 minutes or so talking about Microsoft and security, and we'll spend the second 10 minutes talking about broader themes in information security. We'll close things up with our Newsmaker rapid-fire Q&A, which you won't want to miss. Dan, first off, we have to talk about the Microsoft paper because you were, of course, famously fired as CTO of AtStake the same day the paper was released, and you reportedly found out about it through a press release. So my first question is, did that incident turn out to be the best thing that ever happened to your career? And if you had to do it again, would you do anything differently?
I wouldn't do anything differently, I don't think. In terms of the best thing, honestly, the best thing that ever happened to me, and this goes back a long way, was I worked in a paper mill, and because I didn't have the physique of a real man, they stuck me in the computer room where I ran card sorters and things like that. That was a long time ago, but that's how I got my start, because I wasn't a real man. The guys who were real men, the members of the high school football team, were paid three times what I was paid, but they strapped a tank of Agent Orange on their back and went out and killed broadleaf trees in the plantation all day.
Now, the paper that you co-wrote famously warned of disastrous security consequences in a world dominated by Microsoft machinery. 3 years later, Microsoft has widely been credited for improving its security with XP Service Pack 2, its monthly patch cycle, and its hosted clients' defense offerings, not to mention its upcoming Vista OS. With all that said, is the paper's opinion of Microsoft still accurate today?
Well, yes, because the point was about the monoculture and, in particular, the risks that come from that and the degree to which Microsoft's policies make it impossible for people to choose alternatives. They lock their customers in.
Is Microsoft on the right track with its security initiatives in general? Is there anything you would give it credit for?
Oh, I'll give it a lot of credit. Look, on a monoculture front, in 36 months, we've gone from something that you could get fired for to something that is a DHS research priority and Microsoft own research itself and is in deployment. They're doing a lot of work to make each individual installation of their operating system different enough that, in fact, the monoculture issue goes away. And to top it all off, Richard Clark, former head of cybersecurity for the U.S., has a novel coming out in January whose whole theme is about collapse the information infrastructure due to monoculture. This is an idea whose time has come. Mm-hmm. Is Microsoft doing a good thing? Well, they have a huge legacy tail, which they can't fix, which is why, of course, they bought Kinectix, and virtualization is their answer to all of that. I think it's a good idea. It's a real sharp tool, of course, so it has edges that cut both ways, but I think they're trying hard. The point is that there's some things that are bigger than they are, mm-hmm. and the net effect of their presence is bigger than they are, and they can't fix it.
Now, let me go back and ask you about the point you made about Microsoft locking customers in. Have any of the antitrust changes helped, in your mind, on that point?
No, not at all. Let's be honest, their lobbying beats public prosecutors every day, and that's true both at home and abroad.
Give some examples of how exactly they are locking people in. Is it basically because you take the computer out of the box and it's already equipped with all of these different programs that aren't easily detached or can't
Oh, sure. That's an example. You know, again, it's from their point of view, it's completely rational to make it hard for people to switch to something else. If you make the switching cost higher, this is an economics point. If you make the switching cost higher than the cost of paying the license fee, you stay with it. And that's exactly what they've done. The switching cost is enormous. Try to go to something else. Now, admittedly, Open Office is making that easier, for example. But, you know, companies like to keep doing things that already work. Who would complain about that? People like to be interoperable with others. Who would complain about that? No one piece of this is irrational. The sum of it's irrational. It's entirely possible for many things in life to where no individual piece is irrational, but the sum is irrational, and that's what this is.
Mm-hmm. Now, interestingly enough, on this theme, some out there speculate that Microsoft could eventually have a major stake in the antivirus market, hurting some of the other big players like Symantec, McAfee, and Trend Micro. And we've seen with releases like OneCare and their anti-spyware tool that they are moving aggressively into that market. Do you worry that this is an extension to the whole monoculture threat?
Not really. Two things. One, antivirus is completely doomed. There's a new variant of SpyBot every 45 minutes. Mm-hmm. You know, nobody can keep up with that. In other words, doomed is past tense. Let me quote something from Mike Danseglio, the program manager of their, the Security Solutions Group. In April of this year, he said, when you're dealing with rootkits and some advanced spyware programs, the only solution is to rebuild from scratch. There's really no way to recover without nuking the systems from orbit. That's their guy talking. And it's absolutely true. You know, once things get in, you cannot any longer trust anything. You know, somebody, hooks the memory manager, then they can tell when you're looking for them, and they'll just relocate. There's no way out of that. That's number one. And number two, in other words, they can take this on. They can take on the antivirus market, but it's already doomed, and I don't know why they'd even try. The second thing is, am I worried about other people being a monoculture? Well, you know, for example, Cisco owns the router fabric, particularly at the top end. They're more of a monoculture in that level than Microsoft is. I'm coming at this from being a public health guy.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Now, in Microsoft's case, is the cost of interoperability too high in terms of customer insecurity?
Well, I happen to think so. And I can one statistic that I've heard from people at Microsoft Research is that 80% of the total labor cost for them to bring out a new version of Windows is to ensure their own backward compatibility. That is, if you want to call it interoperability between two versions of Windows, if it consumes 80% of the total labor cost of bringing out a new version of the Windows operating system, that tells you that it's already something that only someone at their scale can afford, and it produces, as a side effect, the cascade failure possibility.
We'll have more with Dan Gere after this brief timeout.
CertSecurity.com has teamed up with network security expert Lisa Pfeiffer to create Wireless Security Lunchtime Learning, a collection of learning tools that fit into your busy schedule. Each lesson consists of a 20-minute webcast, 4 technical tips, and a quiz. So in the time it takes to eat lunch, you could learn how to implement secure WLAN access or choose the right flavor of 802.1X. Check out Wireless Security Lunchtime Learning at CertSecurity.com.
We're back on today's CertSecurity.com Newsmaker podcast with Dan Gere, information security expert and vice president and chief scientist for security consulting firm Vertisys. Dan, looking beyond Microsoft now to the industry as a whole, are there any other organizations or technologies today that threaten information security in the same way that the report suggested Microsoft did 3 years ago?
Well, not exactly, but we're already to the point where the number of embedded systems, embedded in the sense of they are computers but they don't have either a screen or a keyboard or both, are probably outnumber computers in the ordinary sense of the phrase, and certainly will vastly outnumber going forward. Here's a question for you and your listenership. Is it better for an embedded system to have a remote management interface? If it does, then of course that offers an opportunity for someone to take it over improperly. If it doesn't, then you have no way to repair it except to bring it in. And there's a trade-off that's sort of ugly, honestly. How do you cope with embedded systems? And there are lots of them, and lots of them are in things that you'd really rather not have fail. In other words, the reliability requirement's very high. We've seen a lot of that, and the most trivial example is the SCADA systems, which is not what they were built for, but you could think of them that way. Electric power, train control, you name it, your automobile, for that matter. If it's a computer embedded and it has a flaw, do you want a remote management interface to get at it, or do you think that adding a remote management interface increases the probability that somebody will figure out how to misuse that and then everything's sunk? I mean, there's an example. Mm-hmm. Another example would be data loss. If you look at good old Moore's Law, it doubles the CPU you can buy every 18 months for a constant dollar, but disk doubles about 12 and bandwidth about 9, at least in the laboratory. That tells me that the future is enormously more data rich, and yet that data will be much more in motion than it is now. I don't think infrastructure security is any longer the top priority. I think data security is now the top priority. And I don't think there's much doubt about it, and if you don't believe me today, just wait a week or two or five or one cycle of Moore's Law. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, with 18, 12, and 9 doubling times, you get two orders of magnitude of CPU per decade, but you get three of disk and four of bandwidth. And so even though at the end of the decade, the CPU, if we kept building the same kind of computers we had now, at the end of a decade, the CPU would be underpowered by a factor of 10, even though the data, thus overpowering the CPU, could move 10 times faster than it can today. That's another big kind of question mark about where do you want to go next.
What's a specific example that you would give for a worst-case scenario involving embedded systems?
Sure. Worst case scenarios, that's always hard. Certainly something in electric power would be a good example. Certainly something in automobiles would be a good example. Something where suppose that you wanted to treat the router environment, particularly low-end routers, the kind of things, DOCSIS routers that people have in their homes on the cable network. If I could make all of them chatter at full speed and swamp every network tomorrow, which I suppose one could do. What do? You go door to door telling people to unplug? Mm-hmm. I mean, none of these things are the kind of life-threatening things on the first go. But just as I've learned from cryptography, when someone can make a little bit of progress against a crypto algorithm, then you worry that a little bit of progress is like the first crack in the eggshell. You know, more comes later, and I can certainly see how to make a little progress. Different example, if I wanted to go out and write a bad virus today, I'll tell you what I would do, which is assuming that I could, let's just say if I could pick what I wanted to do, mm-hmm. I'd do something that changed the numbers in your Excel spreadsheets just a tiny little bit at random every once in a while. And so pretty soon, instead of 5,000 copies of the company budget, you'd have 5,000 things, all of which resemble a previous version of the company budget, but none of them are alike. And particularly if you modify, say, formulas that way. You know, add 0.01 here, subtract 0.01 there, the columns still total. You know, pretty soon you couldn't trust anything. I wouldn't have to destroy your data, you'd have to destroy it yourself.
Mm-hmm. So, if you're an IT professional and you're in the enterprise IT environment, what are some of the common sense steps you would advise them to take to mitigate the kind of threats that could come by way of what you've just described?
Well, here's the, you know, there's a big fork in the road for us here, and it's like most forks in the road, there's advantages to going both ways. I know at least one bank in New York who's explicitly chosen path B, if you will, mm-hmm. and that is, do we keep having a general purpose computer on the desktop? I think the general purpose computer, under the pressure of, on the one hand, security issues, and on the other hand, the fact that, and I don't mean this as an insult, but the user base cannot keep up with the skill required to be safe. Mm-hmm. That, do you want a general purpose computer on your desktop or do you want an appliance? Everybody seems to be selling some sort of lockdown deal that, in effect, turns the general purpose computer into an appliance, number one. And number two, if you want a general purpose computer, you probably need some sort of constant surveillance on it, going all the way back to the 1983 Orange Book style reference monitor. You need something there that says, if it's going to be general purpose, then you have to have a second process, which is watching the first. And if you're not going to do that, then you've got to go back to timeshare, in effect. And when I said there's a bank in New York doing this, there is indeed. They only a display on the desktop and a jillion virtual machines running on big iron in the back room.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the pressure of security. I'm Whit Diffie, God bless him, Mr. Diffie, as in Diffie-Hellman, as in, you know, inventor of what runs under SSL,
sure.
Said if it weren't for security, computing would be free by now. And although I don't quite believe that any more than I believe, you know, nuclear power is too cheap to meter, but it's an interesting idea. And we are going to have changes due to the security pressure, because at this point we rely on the reliability and the security of our computer systems to a degree where it isn't just an option or an inconvenience or something along those lines. And I'm pretty sure that either we go in the lockdown direction and make appliances and not general purpose computers out of everything, or we go in the direction of having protective surveillance. And you know, which way do you want to go?
Now, in today's IT landscape, well, some argue that integrated architectures from one or a select few vendors can be easier to implement and maintain and make an organization safer. You and others have argued that diversity among platforms and operating systems is essential for security. How should enterprises balance those two seemingly opposing viewpoints?
Well, as I said earlier, DHS and Microsoft both agree that as a research project, trying to introduce some diversity that's artificial is part of the game. I'd refer people who want to Google around to look at Stephanie Forrest's work at U of New Mexico, for example, or Mike Ryder's work at Carnegie Mellon. But what you're asking is, again, a trade-off, and all security is about trade-offs. You're roughly trading off reliability risk on the one hand, ease of management, for example. If everything's just alike, it's the easiest thing to manage, and therefore you get the most reliability, versus the security risk, which is everything's just alike. If you mismanage it or someone else does it for you, you have the most general failure, and it's just a classic security trade-off. I'll point out that if you're thinking about that and you actually are a planning type, that you have the following equation, which is availability. The word availability, you know, how often can you go to the machine and you get what you want, is the mean time between failures divided by the mean time between failures plus the mean time to repair. Or if that doesn't make sense in words, let's just put it this way. The way you get perfect availability is either make failure never happen. In other words, the time between failures goes to infinity, or you make the time to repair go to zero, one or the other. And so if I'm planning, what I'm going to say is that, you know, think of security and reliability and disaster recovery all in one breath, and either work on getting your mean time to recovery moving toward zero, or your mean time between failure moving toward infinity, or both. And if that isn't clear, I will say that I view security as a subset of reliability. And that's the reason I'm thinking of it in that way.
Mm-hmm. Now, you were one of the earliest people to emphasize risk management over the importance of simply locking down systems. Yet in recent months, we've seen a constant stream of high-profile data breaches that have left millions of people at risk for identity fraud. Have organizations then drifted too far toward the risk management paradigm?
Well, honestly, good God, no. Risk management means, in some sense, knowing what you will trade off for one thing to another. We have this problem constantly in the U.S. in particular, but I think in most countries that are advanced, and that is we try to do cost-benefit analysis, and we end up with impossible things in other fields, like how much is a human life worth? You put seatbelts in school buses. What does it cost you to save one life? Versus cost-effectiveness. Cost-benefit says, do I or do I not want to spend the money? And that's in effect what you're asking. Do I or do I not want to spend the money to, say, encrypt every hard drive? Cost-effectiveness says, I'm going to spend X dollars, pick the number, and then from there, how much can you get for X dollars? Which is the way you have to run medicine if you're not going to go bankrupt. It's the way you have to run governments. It's the way we now, I think, have to run security. The first steps in this direction, no, they're not perfect by any means, but I don't think, I was talking to a bunch of bankers the other day, and the rough rule of thumb that I got out of this group, it was just a small sample, don't take it as science, was they lost perhaps 1 in 1,000 laptops a year. Well, one of them has 20,000 laptops. You don't see 20 news articles about them losing a laptop. It happens, we're I think at the moment having a reporting surge, not a loss surge. And keep that in mind as you read the statistics.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've had an accomplished career already, but one would expect that you have a lot of time ahead of you. What do you still want to accomplish in your career?
November or December of 2003, the Computing Research Association and the National Science Foundation held a retreat in which they were trying to get at what are the big challenges that NSF should fund in information in security going forward. We came up with four of them: an end to epidemics, commercial off-the-shelf tools that made security certification actually meaningful, a decreased amount of skill required for an individual to be safe. You didn't have to be an expert like me. You could be an average person. And here's the one I care about: a quantitative information risk management system that is as good as a quantitative financial risk management system. You look at Wall Street, people like me have hung around with banks forever. You look at what they do for money, and how they manage risk and how they buy and sell risk and how risk is quantified to a fairly well. That's what I'm looking for. So if there's anything I can do, that's it. And tell you the truth, Tuesday of last week, we held the first workshop on security metrics. And if you want to take a look at what happened there and so forth, we have a website. I say we, there's a bunch of us, securitymetrics.org. And getting a quantitative improvement in what we do is, in so many words, I'd be happy with that.
Dan, let's close up with our Newsmaker Rapid Fire Q&A. Five questions, not related to security. Keep the answers as brief as you can, and here we go. When you're not working, what's your favorite guilty pleasure?
Well, I'm actually a farmer, so I'm never not working, unless you want to call farming a guilty pleasure.
What's the most embarrassing automobile you've ever owned?
I managed to construct one car out of two. One had a rotted body but a good engine, and the other one was vice versa, and it was Frankenstein's favorite automobile.
If you could choose one superpower, what would it be?
I want the transporter from Star Trek.
On a bet, how much money would it take for you to shave your famous beard?
Well, it depends on who I'm betting with, but let's start with 1,000.
Finally, other than anything you've written, what book do you recommend that all InfoSec pros ought to read?
Well, you know, one I really like is Dan Borgie's The Book of Risk. Dan Borgie, B-O-R-G-E.
Dan Gehr, information security expert and vice president and chief scientist, Vertisys. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And that concludes our special SearchSecurity.com Newsmaker podcast, where we feature in-depth interviews with thought leaders in the information security market. The latest information security news is always available as it breaks on our news page at SearchSecurity.com/news. Thanks to everyone who helped make this possible: Dan Gehr, producer Eric Parizeau, executive producer John Panker, and recording artists Citation Obsolete. I'm Bill Brenner. Thank you for listening.